Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, listeners. Kevin and I need your help.
Yes, we need your help. Please, please, please. We need your stars. We need your reviews, you guys, on iTunes so we can start to climb those iTunes rating charts.
It's simple. Open iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on Ratings and Reviews. Under the Customer Reviews, click Write a Review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
If you need some help, think of 1 star being Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the Road Company of the last 5 years, and 5 stars being free front row tickets to Hamilton. Although, when you think about it, I actually would give 5 stars to the Road Company of Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the last 5 years, because I think that would be awesome.
I would love to hear, can I hear Moving Too Fast as Paul? that's the one I really want.
She's a Shakespeare goddess. Been through Erica Schwartz and Danica Weiss and the Handelman twins.
So there you go. You can also leave a comment if you like.
That's it. That's
your reviews.
It.
Send us your reviews, please. Friends.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain. And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast. Plus, you can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World and The Stitcher.
The Stitcher.
Yeah, I know. No joke today.
That's fancy. Okay. Now, no New York City showcase or cabaret is complete without one rendition of Larger Than Life from my favorite year.
That is so true.
First sung in that show by today's guest. But he isn't just known for my favorite year. Oh, no.
Wow. There was also a chorus line, Falsetto Land, Follies in London. And my personal favorite, the role of Britt Craig, who brought us all real big news in Parade. But then an accident changed the trajectory of our guest's career and open up a whole new career, one behind the table.
To tell us what it was like to share the stage with Tim Curry, sing Sondheim in London, and what it was like to work with such legends as Aarons and Flaherty, Mike Ockrent, and Hal Prince, here he is, just a guy with keys in his pocket. Well, keys and a comb and a crayon are two. Here is Evan Pappas.
Wow, that was good. Okay, good night, everybody.
Whoa,
good night,
man. Good night.
Evan, we're so happy to have you here.
Oh, God, it's great to be here, gentlemen.
Oh, my goodness.
So we have so many questions. Can we start with my favorite year?
Are
you cool if we jump there? We're going to go in a non...
Go from A to E. Do it.
How did my favorite year come about for you? It's one of my favorite musicals.
Oh, indeed. Like, why aren't we seeing it again? Let's get it. Let's go.
Well, you know, they did some rewrites, and I saw it at the York last year, and it was they rewrote, they added, they subtracted. It's really, I think, good. In fact, I said to Stephen Lynn, I said, "Damn, why weren't these rewrites when I was doing it?"
Right.
And there was a great song for Benji. They added in Act One. It's fantastic. I'm like, "Damn,
yeah.
Where was that? You know, 20 something years ago." How did it come about? A wonderful gentleman by the name of Ira Weitzman was a big fan, and they brought me in to do the first, no, I think it was the second reading / workshop down at Playwrights Horizons. And then, in fact, Anita Gillette was Belle, the mother, in that workshop.
Oh, wow.
And it was also, old age, I can't remember the name.
It's all good.
Jim Dale was Swan.
Oh my gosh.
And that was that workshop. And there was a bunch, it was you know, nothing what it turned out to be, as they never do turn out from the first. Just
right.
Like Parade, same thing, from the beginning to what finally culminated, but I'm tangenting. So I did that, and then I just continued with it all the way through to the Andrea Martin, Tim Curry final production at Lincoln Center.
And for those of... if people don't know, can you give us in a nutshell what the story behind the musical is about and who you were in that?
Oh, yeah. Great movie. One of my favorite movies. All right. A little good old Benji Stone, Benjamin Steinberg. Freshman writer at the King Kaiser Comedy Cavalcade show.
How's that? Right.
God,
good alliteration.
Yes. And say that 5 times real fast. And he is the young freshman writer. He was basically the Mel Brooks of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And his idol, Alan Swan, was going to be the guest star of the week, a la the Sid Caesar Hour. And he was notorious drunk. Mm. So they put Benji in charge of this man who was also his idol. So you get the conflict of the story and Benji not growing up with a father. He would go to the movies. He would watch Alan Swan at the movies. He just said, that's my father. Right. That's my dad. Suddenly he's working with his quote-unquote dad, having to take care of this guy, realizing he's not quite all you think he's going to be on the larger-than-life screen. And he meets a beautiful girl. They fall in love at the end, which is how it's supposed to be. Yeah. And then everything works out, and everybody's wonderful, and it's just a lovely. It was a great time.
Yeah,
it was a great time.
Story. It's a great musical.
It's some of the best music. That opening number, come on, 20 million people.
Totally.
That is.
I mean, Flirty and Aaron's,
it's funny
when
you Google things sometimes and to say, you know, best opening numbers. I'm like, wait, why is that not on the list? That should always be on the list.
That should always
there are some lists that if you Google, there's some lists. It's all the obvious ones, which are all brilliant.
Ooh, of course.
I'm like, wait, where is that?
No, they know how to write an opening number.
Yeah, that's
all their opening numbers. Yeah,
every
are fantastic.
Single one,
pretty,
like,
pretty amazing.
I mean, please.
Yeah.
So now we're going to jump back and talk about how we eventually got there. Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Best city in America. I will retire there. I will. When I'm 80, I'll move back. Can't afford it. Nobody can afford San Francisco now.
Oh, it's pricey.
It's the most expensive city in the country. Because of Silicon Valley.
Where in San Francisco did you
grow up? I grew up the first suburb south, Daly City, California.
Daly City,
Foggsville.
California.
Grew up with fog. Fog all day long.
Were your family involved in the arts?
My dad was a florist. Pappas Brothers Florist and Nursery. It was the family business. You know the Greeks. They own florists or diners. Come on.
I mean, come on. So, I live in Astoria. It's
so
true.
You know. Yeah. So, Daly City, California, we were right on the county line. So I was always, San Francisco was my home. Grew up there, went to school there. My family scattered all over California, and I'm the only one who left. Came back east. My mom was a singer. My mom looked like a young Judy Garland.
Oh.
Yeah, she did. And she sang as a kid. She was a beautiful singer. She's still singing, 86. She'll kill me for telling her age. You know, in church.
Yeah.
In church. So she has the voice. My father couldn't carry a tune. But he would go to the theater, and he would know when someone was sharp or flat. It was uncanny. Yeah. We like, what? He couldn't carry a tune for shit.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. I was okay. I don't remember. I really don't remember.
Man.
You know, when you're in high school, you think you're the shit.
Yeah. Of course.
You know, I mean,
did.
All these kids, though, it's so funny. They think that, you know, that's the best thing. And you go, no, it's high school. It's good. It's good.
Where was college for you?
Yeah. Okay. I did a year and a half of junior college.
Okay.
And I quit. I went right to work. My first professional job was downtown San Francisco in a show called Beach Blanket Babylon. Yep, I was in that. Look at your face. He's giving me
the big
wow emoticon.
Wow.
Yeah, I was 19 years old, and I just about 20. 19. And it was at the Club Fugazi, and it's still running. Club Fugazi is, what, 45 years? Beach Blanket is 45 years?
Yeah.
50 years now? Yeah, I went downtown. There was an audition in the paper, and I said, I'm going to go to this. And then I said, no, I'm not going. And my sister said, wait, you're not going? Well, I said, I don't know. I got really, really paranoid and really insecure about it. I'm going to the first professional audition. And my sister said, you're not going? I went, all right. So I kind of have her to thank for this. She kind of shamed me into it. And I went down, and I was number 10 of about 100 and something. And I went and sang, get this, really, at 19, I sang Buddy's Blues. Couldn't even remember. Couldn't even remember the words. Couldn't even.
I love that you knew about it, though. You were
Oh, Sondheim for me was like, whoa. Well, I listened to,
of course,
Ad Nauseam, Night Music. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were all,
okay.
So it was big. That was big for me. West Side Story, you know. Finally said, I got to play Tony. I finally did twice, you know. But I went down to this audition, and I sang, and I went, okay, I'm done. And I started leaving the club. It was packed. I mean, it was packed. And I started leaving the club. And the dance captain / associate director, whatever, Bill Kendall, who sadly is no longer with us, he ran after me, stopped me at the door, and says, where are you going? I said, I'm done. I was so young and naive. He said, no, we need you to come back later and dance. I said, well, what time? He said, about 5:30, and this was like 11 in the morning, so I went all the way back home, and I went back downtown. And I danced, and they hired me right there that day for the understudy in the show because, and this is what I tell students, I fit the costumes. Really I was fit that? The costumes, the guy, and I looked like the guy that was leaving.
Wow.
Yeah, it's one of those. So I did the show for a year and a half. And, oh, should I continue the story now?
Yeah.
Okay. So I did the show about a year and a half, and I ended up taking over one of the roles, and I did a Joel Grey impersonation as the MC. That was my little thing in the show. And it was a great time, great learning experience doing 8 shows a week. That was my first. Yeah, so I never went back to college because right after, so then I was offered a job to go to somewhere in Sweden or something to do this. To do like this song and dance man opposite this Pia Zadora type person. Okay. I don't know. I don't remember the woman's name, but she was big up there. That was some kind of name like that.
And you were dancing.
I was a mover.
Okay.
I was a mover. So this was 1980. Yeah, how old am I now? And they had these $99 junkets, round trip junket things for airlines to go to New York and back. Round trip, $99.
Oh, man.
And it was this big deal. So I went, I'm doing it. So I got this $99 round trip ticket, went to New York. I had some friends in New York, Ron and Leanne, who I'm still very close with. And they grew up in Daly City like me. And I said, I'm coming out. So I came to New York by myself. I was 20 years old. I saw 13 shows in 10 days. My first show was Sweeney Todd with George Hearn and Dorothy Loudon. And cut to many years later, I'm working with George Hearn.
Oh, my God.
On stage. And it was like, wait, what? Yeah, so that's my Carol Burnett story. That's great. And so I'm seeing all these shows. I'm doing all this stuff, hanging on my own. I had some friends. And my friend Karen Curlee, who also is from Daly City, South San Francisco, I went out with her one night. And I forget the name of the restaurant, but I was there. And there was this guy named Jim Young sitting there. And he was in A Chorus Line on Broadway. So Jim Young says, you know, you're like perfect for the role of Mark, the 20-year-old kid who thinks he has gonorrhea. I said, yeah, okay. And he said, you know, you should audition for it. I'm like, yeah, right, great. He goes, no, they're having an audition on Friday. He gave me this information that he needed. They're looking for somebody. And he said, go to the stage door tomorrow, knock on the stage door, ask for T. Michael Reed, who also is sadly no longer with us. And he said, but don't tell him I told you. I said, okay. So next day's Wednesday. There's a matinee. I go to the stage door at the Schubert frickin' Theater. I knock. They come. Can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'm looking for T. Michael Reed. And they said, what's it about? And I said, I'm not supposed to tell you. Okay, talk about young.
So green.
So green. Wet behind the ears. Oh, so gosh. T. Michael Reed comes to the stage door. He gives me the once over. And I said, hey, I'm my name is Evan Pappas, and I'm doing Beach Blanket Babylon in San Francisco. Well, at that time, Steve Silver, who created Beach Blanket Babylon, was working on something with Michael Bennett. So they knew about Beach Blanket, which was great.
Yeah.
Stars are aligning already. And I said, and I hear you're looking for the role of Mark. And he said, how did you know that? I said, I'm not supposed to tell you. So he said, hold on. He went, shut the door, came back. Somebody else came out with him, gave me the once-over and said, can you come back tomorrow at 11 a.m.? I said, where? They said, here. I said, okay. So I went, oh, shit. So I said, I better go see the matinee. So I got my very last ticket. I got the very last ticket way, because the show had been running about 5 years, and it was still a very hot ticket. And I was sitting way over. I'm taking notes. I didn't know what I was taking notes on. And I'm watching the guy playing Mark. And who was in the cast was 19-year-old Bebe Neuwirth playing Sheila.
Oh, wow.
She was 19.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I'm watching all these people that I would eventually be working with.
Yeah.
So I watch the show. I run across the street to the old Piccadilly Hotel, which is now the Marriott.
Right.
And there was a restaurant in there that my friend Ron was working as a bartender there. I run in. I go, Ron, I have an audition for A Chorus Line tomorrow. And he's like, only you. I've been here 3 years. I can't get seen for anything. You come. And I said, yeah. Anyway, totally kind of like, yeah. So I need music. I have no music. He goes, all right. At that moment, Tony Giralis, who was the musical director, walked in with Cheryl Clark, who was playing Cassie,
for lunch.
And Ron says, Tony, come over here. So Tony comes over, and he says, this is my friend Evan Pappas. And well, Tony Giralis, Evan Pappas, Greek. There's that thing. And I said, yeah, I'm auditioning for you tomorrow. He goes, you are? I don't know about this. I said, yeah, I am. Telling him. And so I don't have any music. He says, well, what have you done? I said, well, I just finished playing Tony in West Side Story. He goes, I'll bring the score for you tomorrow. So more stars aligning. So, and Ron's just throwing his hands up in the air. So I go the next morning, 11 o'clock, and it didn't dawn on me until later that I was auditioning on the Schubert Theater stage.
the
me and one
stage.
Other guy. It was just me and one other guy. And there I am on the stage just looking around and going, wow. But it didn't, it was so surreal that it didn't really click. And I'm there, and they danced me, and I was an okay dancer. I wasn't great. I mean, I was a good mover. You know, I could turn like a top.
Right.
And I thought, nah. And anyway, they said, can you sing for us? I went, yes. I said, good. Now we're getting, I'll get them now. So I said, well, you want to hear Something's Coming or Maria? And they said, I said, no, I'm going to sing Something's Coming because I think it's more like the kid.
Yeah, totally.
So I sang it, and I saw them all lean forward in the house in their chairs listening. And I was in my head, all I could think of was, yes.
Yeah.
And I finished, and they said, could you sing a little Maria? And I went, yeah. So I sang a little of that. And then they had me read the role of Paul. And I said, oh, no, I'm here for Mark.
Oh, my God.
And they laughed so hard, and now being in the director position that I'm in, I know they went, this is refreshing.
Yeah,
this is refreshing.
Because when someone truly is that green, so like endearing in a way.
And it was, so I read it, and they hired me for the role of Paul. I went home for the very first bus and truck. And because they were turning the international company into the new bus and truck, and they wanted really young people for it. Because it was one night stands like crazy. I mean, it was a hard, hard road life. I went home with a job. Yeah. I went home with a Broadway touring company. Unbelievable. It was truly. And because of that, Bob Avian became a real champion of mine.
Who was this? Which staged the original, or would teach the choreography?
He and Michael Bennett. I got to work with Michael Bennett.
Of course, yeah. That's right. He
came out and sprinkled his magic fairy dust on the group, and he moved people around. And interestingly, I was let go from the role of Paul because the understudy that came in, you saw him walk in the door, and I went, "Well, that's Paul." I knew it. He's to this day one of my best friends. We didn't let that get in the way at all. That thing that happens,
that
nemesis
control,
thing.
But
I knew it. Yeah. And they even said to me, Michael Bennett said to me at the time, we're in the regions. We can't have Dustin Hoffman playing Paul. In New York, it would work. And I looked at him with tears in my eyes. I said, I knew he was right. Mm-hmm. They moved me to another role, and I stayed, and blah, 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 blah. And I ended up in the Broadway company a year and a half later.
In what role?
I went in as an understudy for four roles.
Nice.
And every time they offered me, because I had played Al the husband for a very long time on the road, and I learned how to dance way better.
Yeah.
I could dance that show really well, but I wasn't that kind of dancer that you put me into, like, Moving Out or something.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I was more of a showman. But Bob Avian became my real champion. I mean, he threw me in Dreamgirls as the Cadillac boy for a while. I got to go to Japan. And then he's the reason I went to Follies in London, because they needed young David Healy, who was an American over there playing older Buddy. And they said they couldn't find that energy over there. It's a different energy when they try to do the American thing.
Yeah, it's
totally.
And it really is.
It is.
And they said, we have him in New York. We got Evan Pappas. And so I went and auditioned, and I went to London for a year. And also because of that, I got to do Merrily We Roll Along over there.
Right.
So the Lester production, yeah.
So that was like 87 around then.
87, 88.
88.
Yeah.
And so it was all because of Bob Avian that you went over to London to do that revival. I mean, that...
Well,
that
yes.
And did they audition here in New York?
I mean, they auditioned here in New York. And they saw a handful of us, and then I got to do it.
Epic.
And that's what I called my favorite year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And also because of Bob, I got to fill in that... was the show Putting It Together on Broadway, and I got to work opposite my idol Carol Burnett, and that was
did
fascinating.
You?
Oh, I did.
What's it like working? Well, first of all, maybe even a little so more.
I'm jumping on you guys.
No, this is great.
I'm like panting. There's so many questions I have now. Know,
but also, you're not only Carol Burnett, but you're also getting to work with George Hearn, who is
I got to see. My first Broadway show.
So full circle. Crazy. Did you let him know?
I did, absolutely. That's the first thing I said to him.
Yeah.
I'm some tears in my eyes here. When I left the show, because the gentleman I replaced for a couple of weeks, when I was leaving the show, George came up to me and just bear hugged me to death and just said, we are so sorry to see you go. The show has changed with you in it. He said, you have been such a joy. I'm getting a little emotional here. It was a great 3 weeks of my life. It was an amazing time. And I just didn't want to go. I didn't want to leave.
Yeah.
But, you know, I went in to fill in, and they weren't sure if he was coming back, and he did come back. And George I was like, here was a man that I saw playing, you know, Sweeney Todd, and it's just the biggest gentleman, just the loveliest, loveliest man.
That's so wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
He is a talented.
That's refreshing. God, so that's good. Really refreshing.
I'm going to jump back a little bit to just finish this up. So you were getting offered in a chorus line actual roles, but you still wanted to be the understudy.
Oh, yeah, because all the roles on the line are white contracts. They're all principal contracts. So if I went on for a principal, I'd get another eighth of my salary.
That's right.
And I'm going to say it. It was a party time on Broadway.
Yes,
if you know what I'm saying.
In the 80s.
It was a real party
time.
So it was a good time. Yeah. And so there were a lot of absences and illnesses. And so I was on a lot and in all the roles. And so it kept me fresh.
Those eighths add up.
Well, I would come home with double paychecks every week, every other week. So I preferred it. Every time they'd offer me the line, I'd say, no.
Yeah.
Because it kept me fresh. And I had been doing it for so long.
Yeah.
I ended up doing that show almost 5 years.
Really?
Yeah, and I finally kind of had like a mini nervous breakdown. They wouldn't give me a leave of absence to go actually to play the MC in Cabaret.
That's crazy.
Over at George Street Playhouse when I was about 24.
Oh.
And they wouldn't get, because they said, we have to replace you with two people. And I went, yeah, but that's not, but you're letting everybody else take a leave of absence. They wouldn't let me take one. I went home, actually had a bit of a breakdown, and I went back the next day and I gave my notice.
Good for you.
And they said, what are you doing? And I said, I realize that I don't want to stay here for the rest of my life. This is not why I went into the business. I need to be out there playing roles. I went back to acting classes. Nice. I kept studying. I always study voice. But, you know, you get lazy when you're in a long-running show. You really, that's your life. I mean, and I just said, I can't do that. And the minute I gave that notice, my life just turned around. It just started happening. It
takes a lot of guts, though, because that's you're turning down a lot.
You know, I even did something that I'm a little ashamed of, but it was a career move. I even took a chorus line off my resume for like a year because people only saw me as a dancer. Not as a singer and not as an actor.
I think there's something valid there. I do.
I think so. And I felt bad. I know my colleagues were offended by it. It's back on. There's no question. I put it way back on.
No, but if you were known for something so specific in this business, it
I
is
couldn't
easy.
Get
You're
seen.
Be the answer.
The only thing I was getting seen for were, can you come in for Cats? And I went, yeah, but that's not me.
And to cover this role or to cover...
And I had to make that choice at 26 or 7.
Talk about taking control, though, of
that's really
your career.
I wish... You know, sometimes I wish I had those balls now.
Yeah, amen. I mean, come on.
Don't we all...
Talk a little bit about this Follies in London.
That was great.
Directed by the great Mike Ockren.
I have to tell you, Mike Ockren, I learned more from that man, watching that man. That production, people called it the kinder, gentler Follies, and it was. But I've seen many productions since, and everybody loves to compare that production. Everybody wants to compare Follies. You know, it's like...
They do.
It's like, it's kind of exhausting.
Yeah.
You're like, this was the best, or this was the best. And... I know, and everybody who's done it always thinks their production is the best.
Sure.
There's something about the show that you really just you fall in love with the machinations, the chemistry, the people. You know, working with all those older people. Oh my God! I mean, working with Diana Rigg and Julia McKenzie, Dan Massey, David Healy. God love them. Dan and David no longer with us. Dolores Gray, who took me under her wing.
Dolores Gray.
Dolly Drops. Yeah. This is Dolores. You know, she was the child star.
Yeah.
So she'd always talk like this. She'd answer the phone, hello. And I'd say, Dolores, it's Evan. She'd be, hi, baby. I'm telling you, she was fabulous. I have such stories about that show, but we don't have these hours, do we?
I wish.
Dolores, she was always the last one to get on stage. Always the last one to get on stage. And you kept hearing, Miss Gray to the stage, please. Miss Gray to the stage. And she was way up on the fourth floor with us guys in her own dressing room. Was the only place. And she said, I want my own room. And she demanded. So they said, well, you got to be up on the fourth floor. So you hear her every night. Finally, always going down the stairs in that very heavy sequin dress. Clang, clang, clang. All the way down the stairs, right? These cements. Yeah. With her dresser in tow. And she, one night, it was getting so late, like, Dolores, to the stage, please. Miss Gray, to the stage, please. And finally, I just yelled really loud, Dolores, would you get your fat ass on the stage? I want to go home early. And it echoed through the whole building all the way down because it was all cement. It echoed all through the Shaftesbury Theater. The resident director, or I can't remember his name right now. I feel bad. He came up to me after the show started. He came up. He said, oh, my God, is that all that needed to happen? Why didn't you do this months ago? And she was always pretty on time after that.
That's hysterical.
Yeah. Oh,
How did audiences respond to this production?
Great. I mean, it was one of the longest running runs of Follies they've ever had.
And it's a great cast recording, by the way.
It's not bad. It's not bad, yeah. They responded really well. Interesting, the New York Times came over and they did not love it. So that's why it didn't come over. Mm. It's that whole thing. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's why.
In the 80s, the New York Times had a much bigger...
In all fairness, I mean, didn't he write his thesis on that show?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's like his baby. Yeah. So, you know, to please... Yes, it was. So it was unfortunate. It would have been great to come back over here with that show.
Was Sondheim around? Because new songs had gone in.
Oh, yeah, there were new songs. There were new scenes. We were all part of the script meetings and everything. I was like, wow, I'm in these script meetings with all these stars and all these. It was like, whoa. And this is a true story. Why would I lie? We were sitting in the script meeting, and something happened because they're rewriting all the book scenes with the kids, too, because they brought us all in earlier. In the second act, we were all talking to each other. The olders were talking to the youngers. When they were doing, when David Healy, older buddy, was singing The Right Girl, he was singing it to me, his younger self, trying to convince the younger self that I did okay and that my life is okay. But by the end of the number, that your life that you is fine. By the end of the number, it reduced me to tears, which he saw himself in me, which reduced him to tears.
Interesting.
It was really kind of cool.
Yeah.
It was really cool. I thought the convention of it was great. There were a lot of... But we were sitting in the script meeting, and I said to them, I actually said to Jim Goldman and the table and Mike Ockren and everybody, I said, I know I may be out of line here, but I'm in this scene, but I feel so passive. I there's no action for me here. What am I doing? Is there something I'm to? Is there? Am I looking at him disappointed? What have you done with my life? And this and that. It ended up in the script the next day.
What?
Yeah. I was like, what? I even threw a punch at him at the end. I threw a punch at him later in the show, and I actually hit him in the eye once.
Oh, whoops!
Yeah. Wow,
whoops.
Though, how incredible!
It
to
was
be
pretty
part
incredible.
Of that
yeah.
Now, Mike Ockren was a wonderful director.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No,
Mike,
no.
Love him. Love him. I'm telling you what I learned from that man. Invaluable.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah,
of something?
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of I see productions where the scenes are over and people just walk away from each other. I'd be like, wait a minute. There's got to be a reason you get on and off. To me, it's directing, acting 101.
Yeah.
He would be like, let's continue the conversation. He'd say, come over here, let me get you another drink. And that's how they go over, and then the next scene would dovetail. So there was always a reason why it just didn't stop and you exit in the next scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've seen done a lot.
Yeah.
He really gave people reasons to come get on and get off.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I thought it was terrific, mm-hmm. you know, really terrific. He's kind, mm-hmm. he's gentle, he's clever. I think it's so sad that he's no longer with us, you know. It was such a great experience.
Watching him, did you know that you were going to be a director at some point?
I knew it from a kid.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I always worked as a leading man.
Yeah.
So I knew it from high school when I was directing things in high school, right?
Yeah.
High school, really. Graciela Danielle, when I was doing falsettos up at Hartford, the iconic production that sadly no one's seen since Hartford.
Yeah.
She even said to me, my darling, you know you should be doing this. I said, I know, but I keep working. And then I started foraying into it 2005-ish, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I had that horrible car accident I was in 2007, which kind of, so I had a year of recovering, and it made me really reexamine things again. And that's when I really started foraying, you know.
And going after it.
Yeah. And it's such a good fit, man. I love actors.
Like
I love actors.
Yeah.
I love actors.
When you've done it yourself.
Yeah, and yeah. You know, and there are a lot of actors who can't direct, a lot of directors who can't act. I mean,
very true.
It's true. I mean, I would like to say that I love vision. I love visual. I love staging. I love inventive staging. And I love working as much as one can with moment-to-moment acting with actors, which actors crave, which I craved and didn't often get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you work with a lot of traffic cops.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I love it all. I sometimes think I'm a better person as a director than I was as an actor.
You know, you brought up in your explanation, though, this epic production of Falsettos.
Yeah.
That
it was beautiful.
Only, unfortunately, people in Hartford got to
Well,
see.
You know, Frank Rich came up and reviewed it, and he you couldn't pay for a review like this. And it was the biggest hit in New York, and we weren't in New York, and everybody was clamoring to get seats. We're trying to come up, and it was sold out. I played Marvin. Roger Bart played Whizzer. Nice. Adam Heller played Mendel. Barbara Walsh played Trina. We had twins, one did the first act and one did the second act.
Love it.
Andrea Frierson, who did Once on This Island,
oh,
original
right.
company, she played the doctor, and Joanne Baum mm-hmm. played uh-huh. Cordelia, I'm pretty sure.
Nice.
It was
what
a gorgeous cast. Gorgeous cast.
So,
Barbara Walsh ended up coming to Broadway with the original.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Right. But this was Graziella Danielle. She did a whole different version, and she's a very passionate woman.
Yes, she
is. So it was a very passionate production. You know, like we were in bed with literally no clothes on.
Oh, wow.
Singing.
Oh, wow. And just for our
love song.
Our listeners' chronology, though,
yeah.
this is predating the Falsettos that's going to come to Broadway in 92.
Yeah, this was 91?
90. Yeah.
We were supposed to come to Broadway with this production.
I see.
And you can go back and you can look at all. It was like we became this. It was this firestorm of craziness because you had the two different camps, and we just went to do a job. We just went to do. It was the first time they put Falsettos together, the two. In fact, at that time, it was still called March of the Falsettos and Falsetto Land. Mm-hmm. They weren't calling it Falsettos yet, and we just went to do a job, and it became such a hit. That suddenly we were coming to New York to Lincoln Center because the Playwrights Horizons team moved up to Lincoln Center. Andre Bishop.
Oh, right. Yeah, they transferred over there.
Ira
yeah.
Weitzman,
yeah.
the whole group. And it started, unfortunately, kind of a war between the camps. And finally, it just got pulled and people felt it was not fair to the original group, and we just went to do a job.
Just
we signed a contract
theater.
For Hartford Stage with Graziella and Mark Lamos, yeah. and we ended up getting pulled, and Graziella's production was realized for a thrust because there was that iconic AIDS quilt on the back wall. Mm-hmm. Do you guys know about this?
No.
Okay, so what the final moment of the show. Because the show was in thrust. So final moment of the show, the huge back wall of Hartford Stage, and we watched them painting this daily. In fact, we all had friends who had their own squares on the yeah. quilt. The very final moment, there was a big scrim, and there was up stage, I guess it would be stage left. There was one, you saw through the scrim, you saw one little square, and it just said Whizzer.
Oh. Mm.
And it lit up. I'm getting goosebumps.
Yeah,
it was. Frank Rich called it a coup de theater.
It's very effective.
Coup de theatre, whatever you say. And then all of a sudden, the whole back wall started to come alive with patches, like almost a full AIDS quilt. It was the size of a football field, and they were building hundreds of these. We're painting hundreds of these every day for months, and then you just heard a click and. And this scrim just dropped to the ground, and there was this quilt, and it was just it was stunning. It was absolutely stunning, and there's some pictures of it somewhere. And it's a shame. I mean, it was a beautiful production.
I had no idea.
Yeah,
I honestly had no idea.
Yeah, because you're young. Existed.
Yeah,
you be young.
But I just didn't
As
realize
is,
that there were two productions of the same.
Yeah, well, it's not. I mean, there are many productions of Falsettos now. And
right, but
pre-Broadway, there was you know. I mean, and what is another fascinating thing is one of the first things I saw when I moved to New York after I got off the bus and truck of A Chorus Line was March of the Falsettos at the West Side Arts.
Oh yeah, yeah.
With. Soon to be my friends, you know,
yeah.
Rupert and Bogardus and yeah. Allison Frazier. And I saw that, and I remember saying, this is what I want to do, dramatic musicals. Mm-hmm. Everybody assumes I did Guys and Dolls, and everybody assumes that I did How to Succeed. Those eluded me for some reason. I always wanted to do the dramatic musical, and I was lucky to be able to do a lot of those. So to cut to how many years later, and I'm suddenly playing Marvin... crazy. And that they're beautiful productions. Oh my God, Lapine's productions are gorgeous. You know, it was weird to suddenly be in this weird thing with people that you all love and respect. And I remember when I went and saw the production on Broadway, I was weeping for my friends on that stage. I was so happy for them. You know, they deserved it so much, you know, to be there. And for all their accolades, it was a pretty beautiful. I haven't seen this one yet. I haven't seen it.
No, I'm seeing it Wednesday.
Yeah.
I'm very excited to see it.
Yeah.
Was there no recording made? Was there a recording made of the Hartford stage?
I think there's bootleg videos running around.
We'll track them down.
Yeah, you will.
You guys know where to find us. Just let us know out there.
Please, yeah, please.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Tell us about your relationship with Aarons and Flaherty.
Because
it's now been on a couple of shows.
Yeah, started with Lucky Stiff.
Lucky Stiff.
Which is a favorite.
Out of the only theater in Baltimore, Maryland. And I had pretty much gotten back from doing Young Buddy. And I went in and auditioned, and I had all this. My hair is actually, it's pretty, it really gets very curly and long. And Lynn just remembers seeing me walk in with all this curly hair. Long curly hair, and I auditioned and I booked the job, and it was again one of my top five favorite experiences ever in my life and my career. Working opposite my best friend Tia Spiros, who played Annabelle Glick, and we went up there and we were the sleeper hit. They extended us a week there. We won Helen Hayes Awards. It won Best Production over. It was Arena Stage was doing On the Town. It was all the talk. It was all everybody. We beat them out. Who knew? And I won for Best Performance. I have a Helen Hayes Award.
Yes.
I'm sitting on my desk. It is just it is the equivalent of the Tony.
Yeah.
And the community in DC is fantastic. It's just a great community. And I couldn't go to the awards because, believe it or not, I was playing Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar. Yeah, I was playing Judas at a three-city tour. Ruined my voice, yeah. And they wouldn't let me out to go.
Wow.
They wouldn't let me out, and I don't know why I didn't say, well, I got to get my notice or something. They didn't let me out, and I won.
That's crazy.
And I couldn't even be there to accept it.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Well, congratulations.
So fancy.
I know.
A belated congratulations.
It was a great experience.
Let's come back.
But then my favorite year happened after that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because of Ira and Lynn and
right.
Steve, of course, because they knew me from that.
So here's the next one. Okay, yeah. Great. So now you're working on My Favorite Year. You've got, it's you, Tim Curry, Andrea Martin, Lainey Kazan. These are heavy hitters here.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, the show wasn't as successful as everyone thought it might be.
Yeah.
Why is that?
You know, there's so many theories. I mean, at that time, what was this, 92?
Mm-hmm.
Things didn't open in the fall like they do now. Everything waited till the spring. So it was almost looked on as don't do it. It's like danger, Will Robinson, don't open a show in the fall. Winter, people would say, oh, the vultures are out. And I went, man, they just couldn't wait to just take it to task. You know, and I wonder sometimes if it opened in the spring, would it have fared better? Because it was the spring. It was Goodbye Girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know what else was that year. I don't really remember. But I just wonder because I don't know. It needed more work, perhaps. I have my theories, but I can't. I don't want to.
Sure.
Because some people will say that I was miscast.
Right.
You know. Well, it happens.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some notices of critics who only wanted to see me play roles like Marvin.
I was going to say
Harry Bogan and I Can Get It For You Wholesale. I did the first revival of that downtown.
Yeah.
And that brought me to the forefront of the community, actually.
Right.
And I played not nice guys.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly to play a nice guy, they were like, I don't know if I'm buying this. It was weird.
Oh, how interesting.
And he was, yeah, there were some notices like that. They felt miscast. I know. And others said, like, how wonderful he is. You know, that's the show I stopped reading reviews.
Oh, I was going to ask you about
that. Oh, my
that.
God. Yeah. I tell my students, I don't read reviews. Because I have this theory, and a lot of my industry friends don't read reviews till maybe the show's over or something. I have this feeling that if we give them the power that they say that they're right when they say we're good, then we have to give those same people the power that they're right when they say we're bad.
Correct.
Now, some people may disagree with me on that, but I think it could really hinder somebody because someone like me, whose thin's not so thick, skin, that was cute, whose skin is not so thick, who can't let things roll off the back so quickly. I'm better now that I'm 108 years old, but, you know, to read them and have to go to work and to give them that power that they're right. So I stopped reading them. As an actor, I may have read them when the show was over to get an idea. You know, because, you know, we're all those that you get 9 good ones and 1 bad one, you dwell on the bad.
Yeah.
What the hell is that about?
And
why
and
do
you
we
get to
do
that one moment in the show where they talked about and then it's always in your head?
Yes,
or something.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah.
And how do we know? Like, you know, you go to an audition and if you look like the brother of the producer who owes him $500, you ain't getting that job.
That's no way.
You know, we don't know why,
yeah.
You know, and critically, you can read all these different reviews and what did they have for lunch? You know, so I don't know. I stopped. As a director, I read them.
Do you want to ask about your favorite?
Well, jumping ahead a couple years. When did you get started in Parade?
Yeah,
speaking of Lincoln Center,
I wish I could give you the year.
Did you do readings and stuff?
I did them
it?
All.
You did
there
from
were
the very
four.
Beginning.
There were four. I call them freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year, and then. The first reading we did was in Philadelphia.
Oh.
And, okay. I went to audition. I'm trying to remember. Anyway, I went to audition, and I walked into audition, and there was Hal Prince behind the Hal Prince, Alpha Jerry, Jason Robert Brown, and I'm like, whoa.
Did you know any of them previously?
No. And I knew that Hal had come over to see Follies, so I knew he had seen me in Follies.
Ah, good.
And, you know, I just assumed he hated it because it wasn't his production, you know. And so I thought, oh, he hates it, so he hates me.
Right.
You know, what actors do to themselves. It's so stupid. You know, they make it about them. It had nothing to do with it. He probably could give a shit about me.
No, it's classic,
you know?
Though. It's totally.
They just do that, you know. And so I went, you know, I'm going to this audition, and I put on a great-looking suit with an open shirt, and I walked in, and I sang from Bernstein's Mass. I sang the trope, I Don't Know. That's really hard to sing. I did. I sang. That used to be
what, like simple song.
No, I don't.
Of course
know.
Not.
I sang, and I used to. In fact, Seth Rudesky, he came to play it for me. I would bring.
He's played. We've interviewed a couple people that
I was
used
one.
Him
I was one of the. I was one of the first person.
Rounds.
I was one of the first people that ever coached with Seth Rudesky when he was really young.
My God.
Yeah, he's one of my
old
friends. In fact, I introduced him to the Pit of a Chorus Line. So he played in the Pit.
All right. We gotta
Amazing.
Get Seth on.
Yeah,
show.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
I'm so yeah.
But he's.
So
I'm so proud of him, man.
Oh
Jesus.
God,
yeah. He goes now. Ivan Pappas, who? He doesn't even know who I am
Please.
Anymore. And he came to play for me, and I'd always bring him in because it's a hard number to play. It's really hard. And while I was singing this song, I swear to you, you know, Hal Prince, he talks like, you know, no inside voice with him. He said, "This kid is fabulous." And I'm singing. He goes, "You know how good this kid is." And there I am wasting all this time thinking he hated me because he saw production of Follies he probably didn't like, you know. And I'm like, whoa. And because I thought I was auditioning for Leo Frank,
yeah,
which I thought I was really more right for. Huh. And he saw me more as a showman. So he said to me, go look at the, here's some lyrics to the song. And it was big news. Here's some lyrics to the song. Just go out, look at it, and come back in and do it like a monologue. So I went, okay. I went outside. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing with this. I'm looking at it. And I had a glass of water in my hand. And just as I was about to put the water down, and I went, no, he's a drunk. Right. And I brought the water glass in with me, and I just toasted, almost like Ladies Who Lunch.
Yeah, totally.
You
stretch.
Know?
Yeah.
And I started doing this thing with a slight bit of tipsiness, and I was reading this dialogue, and they hired me that day to go do the reading in Philly.
Wow.
And so from there, we did two workshops in New York. The first reading was with a gentleman named Albert Schwartz from Canada who played Leo Frank, who was really amazing. But he was 6'2". He's supposed to be a diminutive man. He was amazing. He was so good. The second reading was with Matthew Broderick. The third reading is when Brent Carver came in. That was the workshop up in Canada, I think it was. Carolee Carmella was a part of all of them. Herndon Lackey was a part of all of them. I mean, there was, but there are about seven of us who remained from the very beginning to the end, to senior year at Lincoln Center.
Wow.
Yeah. And we watched that script morph. I mean, Britt Craig was so much more prominent in the second act.
Right.
Really prominent. And by the time you got to Lincoln Center, he was gone in the second act. And people went, where'd the guy go?
Yeah.
And it was unfortunate. It was too bad. But, you know, it's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's what it is. It was great experience. People who I highly respected loved it with a passion. People who I highly respected hated it with a vengeance. It really divided. Polarized people.
Yeah.
Serious. I was always in shows like that, man.
You were.
I were.
Had a few shows.
I was like,
that,
wow, I could write a book. It's like, yeah.
Do you, going back to your evolution with Parade, do you, I don't want to say fight, that's not the right word that I want to use, but when you see your role getting minimized or you see something starting to diminish, do you ever say, hold on here, guys.
I actually did, Rob. I did. One day we were in rehearsal, and I said to Hal, I said, this is not my ego. And it really wasn't my ego. It was my director dramaturge head. And I said, you know, you've lost Britt Craig in the second act. He said, oh, kid, you're great. You can't take your eyes off you. I said, no, it's not about me. I think the audience is looking to him like the Che of Evita.
Yeah.
Like agreed.
The one-man Greek chorus, what we are to think next. And I said, I know you guys are trying to tighten and do all this thing, get back to the love story and get rid of a lot of these characters. But I think we've lost him. And I did speak up. Wow. You know, I did. But, you know, whatever.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Really, really interesting.
Wow. Yeah.
That's so fascinating.
I loved watching Hal work.
Yeah.
I was going to say.
I loved watching Hal work.
What did you learn as a director and as an actor from him?
Visually, his eye. He's just, it's always in the moment. He was interesting. He works from 10 to 2, and then he's gone. And then Pat Birch would take over. Yeah. I love working with Pat.
Now, talk about legend. I mean,
she's
like,
a legend. In fact, I saw her about a year ago.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Grease 2 lovers, that's her movie.
Yeah, right?
Her whole career is Grease 2.
She's a tough one.
Oh, man. Talk about a workhorse.
And we had a great time putting Big News together. Because, they cut it from the present. Big News is gone. They only do real Big News now. Because Big News was an 11 o'clock number at like 2 o'clock.
Yes.
And people didn't, it was a hard one. But we had a great time doing it. They threw me out of a bar. I did a somersault out of that bar. I was lying flat on my face and singing high G's.
Yeah.
Wow.
G-sharp. Yeah. People didn't realize. They were like, where's that coming from? It was me on my belly.
Oh,
you know, it was,
my God.
She and I had a great time doing it, but she was very hard on me. She was very hard on me. She was like, look, I want to keep you sexy drunk, and I want to, all this thing. And yeah, she was. It was great. It was great. I just wished it. And then I said to Jason, I said, I have a feeling you may cut this number one day, And sure. And Jason Robert Brown was the first one to call me when they were doing the new version in London.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I wanted you to be the first to know. He called me. I wanted you to be the first to know that you were right. We ended up cutting it. And I'm like, wow. Well, I said, well, the good thing is then the only recording of it ever will be mine.
Yes. That's
so true.
And what a recording
And
it
we
is.
Did that oh, in God. One take, too.
What?
Yeah. We did another one. We did one for safety's sake. That was in one take. But, you know, we also did that because we recorded right after the show closed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're all in the right proper voices for it. Totally. It was a sad, sad Mother Day.
Well, and yet, I mean, it's one of those shows that on paper, yes, it ran 3 months, but it's the most beloved. I mean, people
I'm so proud. I'm so proud to have been part of two of the most iconic shows.
Oh, I see.
And
so.
Have and so proud, I say this with great love and tears in me eyes, that I got to originate two incredibly iconic numbers.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so honored, flattered.
And it's preserved.
Preserved.
And it'll be there for ages to come, which is
and
so
we are
special.
So lucky to be the recipients of that, to hear it. Yeah.
So,
oh, no, go ahead, please.
No, sorry. I was going to... So we alluded to the accident. I don't know... I know a little bit, but I. Yeah. How did that... You know, there was a...
In a nutshell?
Yeah.
I was on one of my last acting gigs, major acting gigs. Yeah. I went on the road on Golden Pond with Tom Bosley and Michael Learned.
Nice.
And
jeez.
Yeah, it was great. And it really interesting. We were in Thousand Oaks, California, and that's where I'm from. That's where you're from?
That's where I'm from.
Not Sherman Oaks.
Thousand Oaks.
Which is further toward the water.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was one of our stops before we were go to Phoenix. And all my family in California came to see the show, and it was great. I mean, I have my big, fat Greek family. They all came. I was playing Billy Sr., the husband, boyfriend/husband. It was a great gig. I just got over a bad breakup, and I said to the theater gods, get me a tour so I can get out of town and make some money.
Yeah.
And I went in for this, and I booked it. And my agent's like, you're only in one scene. I said, that's all I want to do. I'm tired of carrying shows. I just want one scene. Just, you know, I played cribbage the whole time. It was fantastic. I learned how to play cribbage
on
with my buddy Craig Bockhorn. Oh, my God. We would just play. We were sometimes late for our cues to get on stage because we were playing our hands. Anyway, so we're in Thousand Oaks, and all my family's coming. And my sister stayed one more night. And so that night we were talking, and I said, you know, if anything ever happens to me, this is what I want you to do with everything that I have, because I have to go home and I have to do a will and I have to do all these things. And I said, and I actually said, and if it's really bad, please pull the plug. I believe in that. I mean, that's just, you know, I was like, I don't want my family to be suffering and all this stuff for how many years, because I'm, you know, all this morbid stuff I'm talking about now. So the next morning, I remember watching her drive off as we're getting on the bus to go to LAX, to go to Phoenix. And I just kept staring at her, and I just kept waving. And that whole day, that series of things that day, was really just kind of a weird, surreal day. And I got a phone call from California because a production of Seven Brides for Seven Brothers that I directed at Broadway by the Bay had been nominated for Best Production and Best Director for me. And I was thrilled, and I get on the plane, and I'm all excited about that. We get to Phoenix. We're checking into the hotel, and the cast is giving the front desk such a hard time. Some of them are just so high maintenance. I say it with great love. And I just said to the people behind the front desk, you take care of them. I'll be last. I'm in no hurry. And so I finally went up, and because of it, I got a really good room. And I go with my friend Kate Levy, who was in the show. She played my wife in the show. And we got in the car, and we get in the car, and it was a little. I knew we were going the wrong way. I said, "We're going the wrong way. I'm turning around." I guess you could call it my florist. I come full circle. My florist delivery boy days with my dad's business, and, you know. So I knew my sense of direction is really good. So I said, "We're going the wrong way," and that's the last thing I remember saying. I was blindsided by a Hummer. And I was in what I call a producer rented Dodge Neon. And you know, and it threw me six, you know, like 2 feet in the car. She had a concussion, but they pretty much left me for dead. And they had to jaw me out. I don't remember anything. I come to find out, doing research and people from Phoenix, a nurse happened by and stopped and was talking to me to keep me awake, and I have no idea who this nurse is, and I wish I knew so I could thank her, because, you know, you go in deep shock, because my injuries were so extensive to the left side of my body. I was in ICU for 3.5 weeks. I was in hospital total 7. I came back to, I had to go live with my mom for 7 weeks in California. And then, and I'm so grateful to my family. And then I came back here and I was in physical therapy for a good year. So it was like the most horrific yet glorious year of my life, because you realize, folks, our industry is so beautiful. It, what we do, our industry, I know a lot of us like to say, oh, people are so snarky. Yeah, it breeds it. We know it. But it is also the most beautiful, loving community of people. With all my career and London and the regions and Canada and L.A. and San Francisco and New York, of course, all the people I knew, I think I got, and I have them in a box, over 600 cards and letters. The flowers kept pouring in. There were donations to my family, because people don't realize that when you, even though the bills were being taken care of by workers' comp or something at the time, Broadway Cares, Equity Fights, AIDS came in and helped out. Mm-hmm. Please donate to them. Please, please, please. But money came from friends of the community to help out the bills that my mom... My mom had to move to Phoenix for 7 weeks. And the hotel, because they liked me so much from that day, this is why I always say be nice to everyone, they kept her at the rate that we were getting. They kept her in the room I was in. So when all my friends, when my family would come from California to Phoenix to take over and take turns helping my mom... they always honored them. It was every little thing we say to somebody, oh my gosh, it just, it can resonate forever, you know. And when I saw those cards and letters, and I'm reading these, and I'm just, when I was able to read them, I just was constantly weeping over the love and that comes from our community, mm-hmm. you know, and from all the jobs that I had, and just hopefully being a good guy. You know,
yeah.
I mean, we all have our moments.
Totally.
We all have our moments. Yeah. I see there's a few in my career that I go, oh, I want to hang my head in shame. But anyway, so it was a fascinating. It really changed. It changed a lot of where I am.
Yeah.
Oh, indeed. You know? Something
it's
like that.
It's been almost 10 years now. I know. Sometimes it feels like 10, and sometimes it feels like yesterday.
Wow.
I can still remember the pain. Oh, can I remember the pain? I'm not going to tell you the injuries, because your listeners, it'll turn their stomachs, but... Unless some of you have good, strong stomachs.
This is, and what a recovery you've made. And then did you realize in this recovery process that you were going to just fully dedicate your life now to directing and teaching, and maybe the acting was going away? Or was that something that was happening?
Yeah, you know, the acting thing, doing 8 shows a week is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I'm 108 now. All right, 107. No, I mean, it's hard. And I know that there are people who really want me back on the boards. And I'm so flattered by it. I miss it. But sometimes I really miss it when I'm directing amazing people. I want to get up and spar with them, you know. I, you know, if something came along and it was a nice little drawing room comedy where I get to sit on a poof, you know, I'd be very happy.
Great.
You know, that would be fantastic. You know, I could do it. To do 8 shows a week, I don't know. And I'm so in love with where my life is right now.
Yeah.
I really am. It's still not any easier. Like I always say, I want to write a book called "I Don't Want to Do the Work to Do the Work." I just want to do the work.
So true. That is right? It in a nutshell.
And you may quote me. That's going to be the
so
title of my
good,
book.
Evan. Oh my God, it's so
you know because we all have to do work, and you go whatever.
No,
we know we're all clamoring.
So good.
But I have to tell. Aren't we almost done?
We actually
almost?
Are.
Yeah.
Can I tell my Carol Burnett story?
Please tell your Carol Burnett
yes,
story.
Please.
So when I was a kid. In high school, my friend Joyce, who lived 2 houses down from me, we would always we wanted to be discovered by Carol Burnett, like Carol Lawrence was, that whole thing.
Yes.
We thought we're gonna be so we would write scripts and they were horrible. We didn't know what we were doing. We were writing these horrible scripts. We would send them to the Carol Burnett show, and all we would get in return was an 8x10 stamped a picture of her or the cast. And we had about 4 or 5 of them because we kept sending them things. And they'd say, that, you know, little lovely little letters saying, thank you so much for your interest. Right at this moment, we, you know, we're not looking to cast anybody, or we're not, you know, I your scripts.
Right
yeah,
now.
Yeah. So cut to, oh my God, this was when I was in high school. So literally 25 years later.
Okay.
I think. They call me and say, we want you to come replace in putting it together. literally had to learn all these Patter Sondheim songs in like 4 days in the stage. It was crazy.
It was the Barrowman track?
No, it was the
Bronson,
Observer.
Oh, yes.
Observer. And
Bronson Pinchot.
Yes. Yeah. And it was Carol Burnett. I'm like, wait, what the fuck? What? And I was like, okay. And so I learned the show, and I hadn't met her yet. And I remember that when they were putting me in the show and they were doing Everybody Ought to Have a Maid, and I was watching the understudy do it, and they're doing it as they directed it, I guess. And I'm watching the maid being all mincy and kind of girly. And I went, and this is my director head, Rob, that you know, and you would do the same. And I'm watching this as an actor, and I said to Jody Mocha, who put me in the show, who I freaking love, Jody Mocha. Hi, Jody Mocha, I love you. Haven't seen her in years. She was putting me in the show, and I said, Jody, can I just ask you a question here? If Carol characters wants to get back at George Hearn for flirting with Ruthie Henshaw, right. Well, why am I playing it? Why would I play it like this? So I said, well, can I play it like the pool boy? And she went, oh. And she said, well, go for it. She said, but if Carol wants, I said, absolutely. If Carol wants it the other way, I will. I am very happy to be Mincy Maid. So I'll get to that part in a second. So when I meet Carol, I tell her, I said, Carol, you know, I have to tell you, I used to write scripts with my friend Joyce and send them to you in high school. And she said, oh, we probably used them. I said, oh, no, you didn't. We watched every week. And she said, and we were talking about it. She said, what did you ever get? And I said, oh, we got a stamped autograph, a thing from you and this and that. And she just laughed. She said, of course. I went into my dressing room, and I knocked at the door into the dressing room, and she said, here, this is from Carol. And it was a 5x7 photo of her, and it said, Evan, this is not stamped, love, C.
Oh,
so I go down to her dressing room, and I said, okay, now I want one for Joyce. That was it. We were immediate. So when I had my put-in, I said to her, look, now I want you to know, it was the same day, I want you to know that if you don't like it, let me know, and I'll change it. But do you mind if I play this like the pool boy? Because, you know, we're working together on stage. And she looked at me with this gleam in her eye, and she went, you go for it. And I played it like the pool boy, and at one point I went over to the bar, and I go to make a drink, and I kind of sexily pool boy-y put my butt out for her to notice it and the thing, and she just laughed. And then at the end of the number, we're supposed to do, I have her down in a dip, and we're supposed to be kissing. She just kept kissing me and kissing me, and she goes, more. And it was fabulous. And then when I would do Buddy's Blues, it was great because I was suddenly doing the older Buddy and my friend David Healy had just passed.
Right.
So I put a couple steps in an homage to him. Yeah. You know? But apparently she watched me from the wings every night. And I went, okay, that's it. I can die and I don't have to do showbiz anymore.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And sadly, I never kept in touch with her.
No.
You know, what an idiot I am.
Well.
But it was one of the greatest, greatest things of my career to be working with Carol Burnett after the high school letters.
Yeah.
You know?
Full circle.
Full circle.
Oh, I have to tell you, one of the greatest things for us has been watching you on stage and now watching the beautiful work that you're producing as a director.
Yeah.
And we know your students because you teach as well.
You're making me cry.
Your students speak so highly of you. So on behalf of
all
of us and all of our listeners, thank you so much for giving us so many great memories. And we can't wait to see what's
next.
Hope
I didn't bore the hell out of you.
No, God, no. We've learned a lot.
No.
I have. So I think our listeners have too.
Yeah. This was our favorite podcast.
Yes.
Liars.
It's a parody.
I see what you did
that's
there.
That's a joke. It's not a good joke, but that's a joke.
See what he did there?
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Kevin.
You guys are a delight.
Oh, my God. Thanks.
You guys are great.
You are a delight.
You guys are great. You can keep doing this.
Thank you.
Seriously, man.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.